thank you to the Bump 2 subscribers listening in. You make this podcast possible, and your support is greatly appreciated. In the second part of my conversation with Tom Cronin, we talk about ancient cultures and what we can learn from their wisdom. We talk about his film project, The Portal, and we explore how being such a cerebral society focused on our devices is impacting our well-being. One of the things you talk about are some of the tools for transformation. And it actually goes back to what you were saying about the secret is that they kind of skipped over the how-to piece of it. Some of the tools you mentioned for transformation, meditation, obviously, time in nature. I think time in nature is so incredibly healing.
Yeah, we've removed ourselves from one of the most powerful tools for transformation. And, you know, we just take it as a given and have done for a long time. And so we kind of don't value that process. And it's just simply a misalignment of values. You know, we build massive high-rise buildings and we put people on 25th floor so far from nature. Then we go down elevators into the basement or down to get in our cars, or we go down into a subway. And we move it from one place to another place and go back up in an elevator in another building. And so there's this really strong disconnect from the beauty and the healing qualities of nature on so many different levels. And, I've just moved to my parents' farm, actually, and it's been great just to sort of get back into my childhood, which grew up sort of digging holes and collecting tadpoles and running amok through forests. So it's such an important part. Now it's hard because we use efficiency as our way of living. So it's efficient for us to be close proximity to our work and our shops and our communities. So we try to compact as much in small spaces. Look at New York for a classic example. And what that does, unfortunately, is that it does remove us from the capacity to connect into nature. But luckily we keep some parks, so it's easy just to go and lie on a grassy knoll in Central Park sometime.
What's one of your most memorable nature memories?
Oh, gosh. I would have to say one of the greatest holidays we had with my family was a camping trip in a place called Kakadu here in Australia. It's a beautiful national park in the northern tip of Australia. And it's got so much history through the traditional landowners, lots of rock art and stuff, and that, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years old. But we spent 5 days trekking through that national park and camping and collecting wood and making our food. And it was raw and primal and hot and sweaty, and we were covered in grime. And to this day, you know, all of us, my children were only 6 or 7 at the time. It was one of our greatest family holidays that we were just so deeply immersed in a way of living that was so raw and primal, but so elevating. You know, I've had holidays walking through the Louvre and, down main streets of New York and Paris and all over the world. I've seen most cities, and without fail, that was probably the most rewarding and elevating and enriching holiday that we've had.
Yeah, there's something about that primal connection. I can't put my finger on just what it is, but it, just as you're saying, it's transcendent and it's elevating.
It's just, you're just so present, you know, and everything just melts away. All the things that you thought were important, all the things that you had mistakenly put a value on or an emphasis on or a priority on, just melt away. And, you know, you think, well, what's a priority right now is we need to get some wood for fire because it's 5 o'clock and the sun's setting and it's starting to get cold and we haven't got any dinner. So you go looking around for wood and it's just so present. And so, something really rich about that. You get out of your head and into the body.
Yeah, probably my favorite nature story was from flying. I used to fly and race high-performance sailplanes. And my plane was a 15-meter plane. It had winglets on the end, okay? So I'm over Tahoe, about 17,000 feet one day, turquoise waters, I mean, just beautiful. And I bank, and I feel the winglet balance on a bubble of air. And I ride that bubble of air up through the sky. And the sun is streaming in the cockpit, and the turquoise waters are below. And just everything became timeless and eternal. It's a memory and experience that I still feel to this day as intensely as I did when I was flying.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? That such a beautiful way of describing that. I sort of was in that experience, even though I'd never heard of, what do you call it? Sailing.
Soaring, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. But that's what nature does to us. And unfortunately, we've become a very cerebral society, which is a society that gives so much dominance to thinking. So our phones, our news feeds, our Netflix, our streaming TV, our podcasts, unfortunately, are all contributing to thinking, listening, and this consumption of intelligence and data. And that experience that you had then was not a cerebral experience. It was a full body experience of being oneness with nature. And that's something that we're very much excluding ourselves from these days because of our cerebrality, if that's a word, of the society that we've created.
Although I would argue that a lot of our technology really brings us down to the lowest common denominator. Look at social media and things like that. And that's where I start to question the value of it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, likewise, yeah.
Now, some of the other things you talk about with transformation is breath and breathing. Where does that come into play?
Hmm. Well, what's being discovered is the power of breath. You know, we take it for granted, breath. And for a lot of us, breath is a very unmindful, unaware process. It just is something that goes in and out of your body, right? But there's a particular default that we can move into, which a lot of society's moved into, is just very shallow breathing and a very unmindful approach to breath. And what we know is that ancient traditions have seen breath as a critical part of transformation. And they're very specific practices that incorporate breath practices to do a number of different things for the body. So we on our retreats and my students, I teach them particular pranayama practices, which is alternate breathing through nostrils. We've got, of course, the powerful Wim Hof method, which is mainstreaming now, which is oxygenation of the body using breath to create a beautiful purification in the body, in the nervous system, but also a very powerful DMT release process through that that breathing exercise. So breath, like meditation, like plant-based medicines, like so many other modalities, is just one of those many modalities that can be used to reshape the way we live our lives and reshape our state of wellness. And that's exciting for us to start to realize that.
And it all goes back to some very traditional ancient cultures.
Yeah, I love that we're progressing so fast into a new world. But we're pulling with it and starting to integrate with that these ancient practices that have stood the test of time. And there's so much incredible. And this is where technology can be so supportive. You know, technology is not going to go away, and it isn't the bad guy. Technology is not the bad guy. It's just poor state of mind is the bad guy that's building the technology. But technology can be so phenomenal and so transformational in helping us learn these techniques. Even this podcast and getting this knowledge out to the world through platforms is part of this transformation. We're not going to be able to get the world into an enlightened state without technology. Technology has to play an integral role in the awakening of the masses, and that's by sharing the techniques en masse across the world through technology.
I'm really amazed at how technology has transformed things, say, in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, you could not have done a podcast. I can market it globally through all the social media platforms. It's really incredible when you look at it.
Yeah, you know, we had one guy stand up at the end of the movie, and he was, dreadlocks and tattoos, and had a particular, I guess, style about him that was fairly what you'd assume would be quite anti-establishment, and he stood up quite aggressively, said, "What do you think about these terrible, evil corporations that run social media that are polluting the minds of the masses?" And I could see where he was coming from, and I knew what he wanted me to say, which was to support him on this. But again, we have to look at the polarity. Yes, there's some definitely some unpleasant and unsavory things about social media, But I did ask him and the audience, how did everyone know about the movie screening tonight? Because you all have a ticket and you all came to the screening, but how did you know that this screening existed? And they all knew about it because of social media. And so it wasn't so much that social media is the problem, it's how we use it can be the problem.
The movie was terrific. I would guess that you had a difficult time editing that.
Yeah, look, you know, Jackie, the director, and Gary, the editor, they worked night and day putting that together. They had a number of arguments and disagreements and also a lot of commonality and unity, and it was a fascinating process to watch them work together. It's such a, almost like a dance that you have to do where someone moves one way and you have to sort of ebb and flow and finding that common ground. And, you know, Gary's such a, they're chalk and cheese, those two, but it's just so funny seeing them work together, you know, peas in a pod in some way. And coming up with a way that was different, unique, a little bit challenging, you know, it is a little bit challenging for people, and some people really struggle with the film. This is, you know, I respect and understand that it's not for everyone, and some people completely are blown away by it and just think it's the best thing since, you know, films have ever come out, and some people just really struggle with it. And we kind of did want to push the boundary a little bit, knowing that that was going to be the case. But we did want to create something that was unique and fresh and was a little bit different in filmmaking. So that's why they sort of pushed it that way.
But I think the personal stories that are part of the film and the book really anchor it. I mean, those stories are amazing. Every time somebody comes up and starts to tell their story, I'm just hungry for the rest of it.
Yeah, you know, we searched far and wide to find those stories. You know, we went through quite a process. We had a team of researchers, and we were looking for a couple of things. We were looking firstly for the stories to have to fit in with global themes of crisis. So we're looking at different global themes. We're looking at AI crisis, war crisis, human displacement crisis. So we're looking for themes that fit into that global theme. Then we were looking for stories that had a crisis in them, and they had to have a crisis in their story, and they had to have used meditation to have moved through crisis, because we know that there's so many different ways people can move through crisis. It's not to disregard all the other modalities. You know, there's horse therapy and, you know, plant medicines and all sorts of things, but we wanted to focus on meditation and mindfulness and yoga. And so they were some of the common things. And then what we had to do is we had to put them through an interview process and really sort of start to, you know, see how that engagement went on the film, on the screen, and how they felt being on camera and stuff like that. So there's a number of different processes. We ended up covering 300 different stories and eventually finding these beautiful stories that we chose to go up onto the film.
How long did it take you to go through that many stories?
Quite a while. It's quite a process. You know, we had a good team that were moving through them fairly quickly, but with the respect that they deserved. It was quite a, you know, if you have to send an email out, you have to have a phone call, then you have to have a Skype or Zoom video. I think it was Skype back then. And then, you know, we had to put that up and record that, and then we had to sort of sit through that collectively as a team and look at how they were responding and all those sorts of things. So it did take quite a while. It was definitely over quite a period of months.
You found just amazing people.
Yeah, we're very, you know, we felt such a strong connection and resonance with those stories. And, you know, what I really love about them is such diversity, not just in the personality and the person. You know, we've got African-American US soldier, we've got a Vietnamese refugee, went to Harvard, you know, a French, you know, lawyer, human rights lawyer that became a yoga teacher. Just, you know, Heather, who was a, you know, track athlete and, you know, newscaster, and then eventually, you know, teaching or, you know, being a sort of voice in the world, doing some great stuff with women's rights. So it's just, you know, such beautiful stories. Dodie, of course, and Ronnie, you know, just such depth and breadth in those stories. It's so wonderful to be part of it all.
Yeah, I've known about Jim Doty for a while, but I never knew his backstory. And the story of how he decided to gift that stock to Stanford blew me away. I don't know if I could have done that. But I can see how, if he didn't do it, how would he live with himself?
Yeah, it was one of those decisions that would have been so difficult. But, you know, he's such a beautiful man with such a big heart. And, you know, I think if anyone hasn't read The Magic Shop, it's a phenomenal book, and that's what really inspired us. I'd read the book, and before I even, you know, started the project. And it was phenomenal when he came up in one of the researchers. I'm like, wow, James Doty, yeah, that's a great idea. So I didn't actually come up with the idea, even though I'd read the book. So, yeah, he's a good man.
Now, what is at Stanford? He's doing research into, refresh my memory, he has a department, I think, at the university, doesn't he?
Yeah, look, he's a doctor. So, you know, we were there when he was operating, and he has patients and clients. He's involved in many projects, but the main thing that he's involved in is called the Compassion Project. Yeah, yeah. So he's doing some great work around that.
Well, you know, one of the things you mentioned is the fact that human behavior is more conditionable than we think, which has its pluses and minuses. But on the plus side, that opens the door to reach people for meditation. If we can get them to slow down enough to pause and do this, what are your hopes for that?
Yeah, you know, the thing when we sell anything, we have to inspire people that this is going to add value. And that's why people watch, you know, streaming platforms. It's why they have a Spotify subscription. It's why they're on Instagram, because every day we're presented with a number of options. Every single moment is a series of options, and we have to make a preference between one option and another option, or multitude of options, as to what's going to add more value to my life. That's why we eat Krispy Kreme donuts or drink Coca-Cola, because we go for generally the shortest path possible to adding value to our life. You know, you can take, I got a bunch of cows here in this paddock where I'm living, and they know that eating grass is the best thing for them. It's just by default, they know that innately. But if I put a table in the middle of the paddock with a massive sugar block, okay, a huge block of sugar, they will ignore the grass and continue to lick and eat that sugar block, because it's the most biggest and most rewarding option and the highest preference over the other preferences of what they can do with their time. And that's what humans do as an animal. We take the shortest route to pleasure and fulfillment. But as we become more mindful, we start thinking about the consequences of that. So you'll find people that become more mindful start making choices that aren't necessarily the shortest route to pleasure, like going to the gym for an hour. You know, it's not as pleasurable, but the result of that process, it's like, you know, doing fasting, or, you know, you see traditions and practices. There's a fascinating correlation which I've found between the cultures and traditions and people that willingly surrender pleasure for the purpose of a higher experience have greater degrees of fulfillment than societies and cultures that take the shortest route to pleasure, where we have chronic levels of depression and anxiety. And there's this fascinating correlation between shortest route to pleasure, highest levels of unhappiness, and, you know, taking the surrendering of pleasure, short-term pleasure, for a higher experience and greater levels of fulfillment and happiness.
I think that for people who are used to setting long-term goals and working, you do run the risk of living for a tomorrow that never comes. Because life never turns out the way you think it's going to.
That's true. Yeah, it's this fine line, isn't it? We don't want to completely remove ourselves from having the joys and the sensory delights of life. It's about, I think, you know, for me, I was all on one side of the fence, which is just finding just short-term pleasure. And then I went all the other way, and that was to do extreme sadhana, which is just, you know, spiritual practices. And we call it tapas, which is the surrendering of pleasure. And then eventually I found this nice middle path that we call it the middle way, which is a little bit of balance of both, a bit of fun, a little bit of cheekiness, a little bit of pleasure, and a little bit of practice. So I give up some of my time each day to do my morning yoga, my meditations, my breath work, my studies, my spiritual practices. And I also allocate some of my time to just the joys and the delights of living in this world and sitting down and slobbing out watching some Netflix.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path, because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life. You can subscribe to our free podcast at www.bumpintheroad.us or become a premium member to hear the full conversation. Just go to www.bumpintheroad.us for more information and to sign up.